Log Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Authority Smashing Up with your hosts, Luke Tim and Mr. 1001 Nights. Join us as we embark on a journey through radical news and politics, take callers, and get you ready to engage in the struggle against capitalism.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Authority Smashing Hour, your favorite anarchist show on the internet. So, here we are once again, and apparently my planned host, Diane, is not going to be here. Unfortunately, we'll have some callers, and as well as our producer, Charnchi, who's probably somewhere in the background. Are you there, Charnchi?
Hey, Jonathan. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you, man. So, yeah, I guess we can start out talking about some of this capitalist politics that we're supposed to be so happy about, the elections. So, you know, as you guys have probably heard, there's some new bosses aspiring for the throne. And so we have people like Bloomberg, and says, you know, GOPers win New Jersey, Vancouver. Government races. Bloomberg retains mayoral seat with slim margin. So these capitalists are fighting really hard for this stuff. It says, election day saw Republicans taking both gubernatorial races while Democrats won the only two House seats up for grabs. And in New Jersey, Republican Chris Christie beat incumbent Democratic Governor John Corzine, however you pronounce it, the former senator and former CEO of Goldman Sachs. You see, these capitalists, they're the ones who get to climb to the top. That's what it's all about. And oh, wait a second, we're having some problems here with the switchboard. Anyway, so and also Barbara Boxer, who's supposed to be one of the more liberal of the politicians, she's competing against a sort of a hardline Republican here, and it's someone called Carly Fiorina, former Hewlett-Packard CEO, who's portraying herself as a business savvy politician, and she's saying that kind of a typical line that Boxer has saddled the country with debt and stifled job creation. Kind of an interesting sort of accusation that you've stifled job creation. It's not that they care about the people performing the jobs. It's not that the wage slaves who actually do the work are somehow, doing anything that they care about, is, you know, because after all, it's all about exploitation. But, you know, obviously the economic repercussions can be pretty severe for the capitalist class. I mean, in terms of, say, you make $100 million instead of, you know, $200 million or whatever. We started talking about these scumbag politicians, and now we're talking about some of these exploitative practices. So we're back on the air, Tarnchi?
I think so. Good news says he could hear us now. And there's a player in my page now.
I wonder what the hell was going on there. Maybe it was my browser. I have no idea. Anyway.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Let's keep going here. So, yeah, we're talking about the Mexican children getting exploited and, you know, the picking. There was a story on ABC picked up by Democracy Now, by these Mexican children who are used in the fields in places like Michigan. And they're migrant workers. They're going from field to field. They're like serfs, basically. And they work for very long hours picking these blueberries. And the profit margin for the blueberry corporations is tremendous. They're making extreme amounts of money. And these pickers, they don't even approach minimum wage. I mean, the kind of exploitation that goes on is pretty heartbreaking. And then, of course, you see the same thing happening in, say, 19th century capitalism, where you had no child labor laws or anything like that. And it sort of reminds us that these capitalists will actually do anything they can, including taking away all the gains of 150 years and putting us right back to the same into the same period where Marx was writing about these things, like 19th century England, where the when child labor was rampant. And in fact, one thing I could say about child labor is that it was encouraged also because the families were benefiting from this. The children right now, for most families, are an expense in some ways, right? Because you have to pay for their school, for their doctors, for their clothing, et cetera, et cetera. But if the children are working, starting at age 5 or 7 or whatever, then they are a source of revenue. So the dynamics of capitalism meant that not only were the workers being exploited by the capitalists, but they were exploiting each other. So the families, the parents were benefiting from the children, and that's the kind of dynamics that capitalism creates. It's pretty terrible. And these blueberries, I mean, they're pretty good, of course, but you can only pick them for a certain amount of time, otherwise they taste horrible. There's a certain time span where you have to pick them up, and they cost. I don't know if you ever try to buy any of these. Have you tried to buy any of these, Charanchi? They cost like $5, $6 for one little box, huh?
Also, there's another thing where, like, blueberries, you don't grow blueberries. They're wild, and you just harvest them. So it has like no cost to the agribusiness,
Right. I mean, there's so many scams going on. The latest thing that I heard, like someone told me that, like, when you go to Starbucks, for example, and they have all these choices, Frappuccino, latte, chai, whatever. Apparently, all the drinks, every single one of those drinks, cost practically the same. Like the most expensive drink and the cheapest drink, they are within like pennies of each other. That is, all the drinks practically cost the same. So you're getting ripped off big time when you get some of the more expensive ones. So in fact, if you wanted to get your money's worth, so to speak, to not get ripped off too much, you would have to get sort of the cheapest drink, one little coffee. That would be sort of the choice you would have to make, because when you get these frappuccinos and these chais and all, paying $5 for a coffee, it doesn't cost Starbucks more than a few cents more than the cheapest drink. So it's a total ripoff. And I think if you actually look into this, you'll see that this is pervasive. That all There's so many damn scams. I mean, when I went to China, I always remember this, that I mean, of course, China is the producer country per excellence, right? It's like there's so much production in China, and they produce, pretty much everything. And I remember that I bought some backpack, and I was with this girl, and she said, "You got ripped off there. You should have bargained. You know, everyone bargains there." But to me, it seemed like a pretty cheap price. It had, it looked like a Nike. It was made pretty well, and but it turns out that the production costs there are so cheap. These sweatshop workers getting paid pennies, that obviously, the real costs are hidden to everyone, because the no one really knows. No one is calculating the sort of labor cost as they go into the product. I mean, someone is, of course, as just sort of to calculate their bottom line. But oh yeah, I mean, it's just incredible. And like the last thing that I saw was, I bought these pants, right? I went to this Chinese store, and I'm jobless now, so buying these cheap clothing. I bought three of these pants for $10, right? They're like sweats. How do you call those things? You know, sports sweats or whatever, sweatpants. I looked at them and I thought these are the same ones that I bought years ago for like $30. So that's the thing, that the prices in a capitalist marketplace have very little relation to the cost. There is a relation in terms of course, if something costs more, you're going to have to charge more if you want to make the same profit. That's just obvious. But very often, they make such a huge profit margin that you cannot assume that the profit margin somehow is a reflection of a sort of a sensible strategy to give you the best possible price. I mean, that's totally nonsense. And, you know, this Starbucks example where all the drinks cost pretty much the same, that sort of should give us pause about the pricing mechanisms in capitalism. So, and as that is going on the other hand, we have the GOP boycotting the Senate climate bill. It says, on Capitol Hill, Republican senators have delayed consideration of a major climate bill that would impose curbs on emissions of greenhouse gases. and here we have to understand why these interests of our society sort of interfere with each other, because the state has in our current state of affairs in a current sort of capitalist dominated system, the state has three purposes. The number one, the main purpose of the state is to bolster the power of capital as a whole within society. So that's the number one purpose. The second one is to benefit certain sections of the capitalist class against others. I've spoken about this before. Certain sections of the investor class, certain sectors have slightly different interests than others, even though they all share sort of common interests. But in the documentary Golden Rule, I talk about this. And number three, they have to counteract the antisocial effects of capitalism for the sake of the stability of the society. So it is that third factor that people can exploit through democratic pressure. That is the necessity of the state, the ability and the need that the state has to impose an overarching stability allows some of the workers to press for their needs, and that's what gives the government the sort of democratic mechanisms that we can use for our own protection. And so we should see this current rejection of the climate bill as a sort of struggle between some of the functions of the state with other functions. So on the one hand, the Republicans are obviously totally devoted to big business, and on the other, the Democrats, which are of course just representing primarily another sector of the capitalist class, they have an interest in protecting capitalism from itself in some ways that the Republicans don't. And I have to say that Republicans are more extreme, and that in fact may not benefit the capitalist class as a whole. Let's not forget that Roosevelt, the social democrat per excellence, right? The sort of person that everyone looks up to, saying, "Well, look how he was a good old social democrat." He was backed by oil, capital intensive industry like paper, international banks, et cetera, et cetera, because these industries had an easier time compromising with the labor movement that was pressing for their demands. The reason for that is that labor-intensive industry employs it means that it employs more workers. And if you employ more workers in your factory, it's harder for you to allow a higher minimum wage, to allow unions to organize, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas if you have a capital-intensive industry, you have an easier time because it doesn't hurt you as much. And hence, that's another reason why the capitalists always try to substitute workers for machines, because the machines very often pay for themselves in the long run, and they end up costing them less. And so, on the one hand, of course, it'll cost you your job. You won't have your job if you're substituted by a machine. But on the other, it will allow the workers to have, you know, have an easier time unionizing. But once again, this is a political dynamic entirely within the spectrum of capitalist domination. So I guess that we're in half an hour into the show, and do you see any questions, Sharnji, in the chat room?
Not really. I think Good News trying to call in from Austria.
From Austria,
we'll see what happens.
Right. We don't. Yeah. I don't see any calls in the switchboard. Although, once again, we were having some serious problems at the beginning, but it seems that we have already solved those. So, what's that?
I have a question about, you just laid out, you know, the stuff that was in your movie, Golden Rules, about how the industry, you know, invests in to control the state. So, if you can apply that, maybe we could do it after the break, but maybe you could apply that to what's going on in the recent, you know, yesterday's election. The mainstream talk seems to be like there's a little backlash against Obama. Maybe you could apply that whole thing to what's going on now.
Right. I have to say that I'm not. I haven't looked at the recent elections closely because, you know, in fact, I just read about them. It's usually not something that I enjoy studying in depth. But I'm sure that there was an interesting dynamic there, and I suspect that the, you know, we know that there's different sectors of industry, and that right now finance is sort of at the top, and so the candidates which are being presented have to be serviceable to, you know, the powerful sectors of industry, the ones that are dominating right now, and that means overwhelmingly finance. Although other sectors, obviously depending on the region, I'm sure have more dominance, but we still have to see this whole thing within a framework in which all these capitalists, they have strong common interests. So one of the things that Ferguson pointed out when I was interviewing him is in 2004, I mean, because I was examining primarily presidential campaigns rather than at the local level. At the local level, maybe slightly different dynamics play out, but, you know, I don't doubt that some of the fundamental principles, such as that money rules the day, I don't doubt that is true as well, but the dynamics may be slightly different because of the sort of a particular needs of the capitalist in certain regions as compared to other regions. So, but yeah, that when Kerry lost the election in 2004, that he gave up so easily. And he said, well, how come he gave up so easily? He said, well, because the capitalist class had decided to put George Bush into office. And so there was a consensus. So you respect the consensus of the business community. That's what it's about. So you collect your tax cuts and you go home and, you know, you toast with a glass of champagne. I mean, that's that's what you do. It's not like these guys really fight each other at every level. They they themselves admit that, you know, this is sort of a show. Behind the scenes, we're all having caviar and champagne together. So anyway, time to take a break, and we'll come back and answer some of the questions that people may have. You can call in. And once again, the guest call-in number is 646-716-8106. Once again, 646-716-8106. So call in, and we'll try to answer your questions. And I want to play a little bit of I guess, what do we want to play? Joe Hill? Let's play Joe Hill. Listens to the praying. Anything you want to say, Charchi?
No, go ahead.
All right.
Play the song.
Look at the steady rifles, Joe. It's all over now. Murder. First degree, the jury said. It's too late now to go back. Listen, Joe. The chaplain is reading.
Lord Jesus Christ, who did so mercifully promise heaven to the thief that humbly confessed his injustice.
Throw back your head, Joe. Remember that song of yours we used to sing in jails all over these United States? Tell it to him. I'll introduce to you a man that is a credit to our red, white, and blue. His head is made of lumber and solid as a rock. He is a Christian father, and his name is Mr. Block. Remember, Joe, you take the cake, you make me ache. Tie a rock on your block and jump in the lake. Kindly do that for liberty's sake.
Behold me, I beseech thee, with the same eyes of mercy that...
On the other hand, we're drifting into jungles from Kansas to the coast, wrapped round brake beams on 1,000 freights. San Joaquin and Omaha brush under the wheels. God made this.
So that was Joe Hill, Listen to the Praying, which looked more like a ballad rather than a song. So that was kind of interesting. But Joe Hill, great American figure. And so we're going to continue with some of the items here that we have on the list. And as you guys know, I was talking about the function of the state, and I was talking about how even though the state is primarily a tool of the capitalist and they regulate the capital power within the society as a whole, and they regulate the sort of struggles between different sectors of the capitalist class, they... have to also counter the antisocial effects of capitalism, which obviously are a very important part of a society, because the exploited classes, working class, and to a large extent even the coordinator class, which has to subordinate its own mental powers to the owners, they are all either mentally or physically exploited. And that means that the all sort of antisocial dynamics occur, and hence they have to establish certain ways to minimize that, to maintain the equilibrium, to maintain that. And one of the latest sort of features that we've seen, and I've been talking about this more lately, is the sort of growth of antidepressants in our society. I mean, I was talking about how children are taking an incredible amount of antidepressants, and you know, it's sort of an epidemic, and of course we have other things like obesity and so on, but these antidepressants are actually there was just a study that just came out, and it's amazing. Every time you can basically type antidepressants on your browser, and every few days you'll hear about a new sort of news item telling you about some new study showing some detrimental effects of antidepressants. But this is kind of interesting. It says, a new study explains what many people suffering from depression already know. Antidepressants are often not effective. Researchers at Northwest University's Feinberg School of Medicine say their findings prove that the medications are treating stress instead of the true cause of depression. That's right, folks, stress. It says long-time depression researchers, researcher Eva Rede says the team's findings topple the common belief that stress causes depression. And I would like to read something else about an written by an investigative journalist, Robert Kuttner, in a book called Everything for Sale. And he says that to be in a life situation where one experiences relentless demands by others, over which one has relatively little control, is to be at risk of poor health physically as well as mentally. This entails a relatively small elite which demands and gets empowerment from the working class, and they get all these benefits, but that has a price. And in fact, epidemiological data confirm that lower paid, lower status workers are more likely to experience the most clinically damaging forms of stress, in part because they have less control over their work. So there's a direct relation between the exploitation, the lack of control in our system, and the and this sort of overwhelming explosion in these antidepressant drugs, ADD, and other reactions to the very, very unhealthy system that it is in place. So anyways, we have some callers, two callers, and so we're going to go in order. And who is the first one here? Hello?
I'm here. I don't know if you're taking me or not. This is Buddha Jim.
Of course we're taking you, man. We take you anytime.
Oh, yeah, I didn't know. You said you had two callers. I didn't know who you were picking. So, but, yeah, this is Buddha Jim calling in. And, you know, we had a wonderful Democratic election yesterday.
Right. I was just thinking that since you live in New York, that you must be ecstatic. You know, your thirst for democracy has been quenched, hasn't it?
It has. It has. We got a really good election. We have the best democracy money can buy here. Mike Bloomberg. Estimates are that he spent about $850,000 per day during the campaign. About $140 million of his own money. I mean, here we have, you know, a lowly, little, struggling billionaire, you know, and he's been able to become mayor of New York. I mean, that's really, I think it's inspiring for other billionaires out there.
No, wait
who
a second.
Might want to spend.
But David,
huh?
everyone has a chance. You could have run for mayor of New York.
Yeah.
So it's your fault if you're not mayor. You can run. You
know,
can do it.
You know, well, I was going to do it. But, you know, I started doing the math, and I was like, you know, $850,000 per day. I was like, you know, that's, I don't know. I mean, I could swing it. I'm a carpenter, you know?
Right,
I mean,
right.
We make that kind of money. It's not a big deal, but,
just get a loan.
You know,
just get a loan, man.
You know.
I mean, like no one said
it
was risk-free.
I was going to put it on my credit card. But, no, I mean, it's sick. I mean, $850,000 per day. You think about that. And that's at the local level.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, granted, obviously New York is a metropolis. I mean, it's we have 8 or 9 million people here. It's not a small city by any stretch of the imagination, but still, it's not the presidential election, you know.
And, sort of makes me think that, you know, that's another aspect that that sort of could be incorporated into the investment theory, because you have a lot of these small mayors, or, well, New York is not small, but for example, here, right. the mayor of San Francisco, he said, well, now I'm going to try to run for governor, right? And of course, Arnold Schwarzenegger, he said, well, I'm going to try to run for president. So it's sort of like money gets you in power at first, and then you use the reputation you've built and so on to run for governor or run for president or whatever. So, I mean, money is important every step of the way.
Well, yeah, and I mean, just what you said kind of reminded me of Bill Clinton kind of being a nobody governor in Arkansas. But he did some, you know, made some pretty politically savvy moves and worked himself up, you know, I mean, he was we all know, elected president of the United States. These are like stepping stones. And I'm sure Obama's went through similar stepping stones to kind of prove his value to the capitalist class. You know, because becoming president, I've done videos on this on my YouTube channel. You instantly become part of that club. You know, you become like you get a you know, your name put in the social register, which is huge. And you become part of that clique, that network of elites that really the movers and shakers of this country, the people who own and control the wealth, the labor, the resources, you know, the technology.
But
you know,
Dave,
that 1% that owns everything.
Dave, couldn't mm-hmm. I do the same thing? I mean, couldn't I just step one stone after the other? Like, okay, right now I'm doing this radio show, but maybe I could become famous and make more money, and then from there maybe I would become the CEO of a company, and then my company could grow, and then I could run for mayor, and then from there I could run for governor. I mean, it doesn't everyone have a chance to sort of...
That's the magic of the market, baby.
Right.
That's the magic of the market. You just got to believe, man. I mean, we... You know, like I said, I mean, I think billionaires everywhere are like, you know, joyous today that Mike Bloomberg won the election. Because, you know how embarrassing it'd be to be a billionaire and lose to like like a millionaire? I mean, think about that. That's like a big slap in the face. Yeah.
David, talk to John Corzine of New Jersey. He's a billionaire. He lost.
Wow. That's got to hurt. It's got to hurt.
Yeah, it does hurt, yeah. I think.
Wow, that's got to be embarrassing. Imagine you're hanging out with all your other billionaire friends, and they're like, dude, you lost to a millionaire. Did you lose to a millionaire, or was it like a thousandaire?
But, you know, one of the things
I'm not sure, actually.
One of the things
I'm like a hundredaire.
That Ferguson mentioned is that money wins most of the time, but sometimes, because of certain flaws in your campaign, what is that?
Whoa, major static.
Yeah, that was Charge. I just cut him off. If you want, call again, Charchi, to see if you can get rid of that static. But anyway, what he was talking about is that, for example, most of the time, 9 times out of 10, the candidate with the most money wins. But sometimes that's not the case for other reasons. Like, for example, in the GOP, you had I think it was Huckabee against Romney, right? And
right.
I think it was Huckabee that won, even though Romney spent more money. But the reason for that was Romney, the Mormon. Yeah, right. He was a Mormon in a right. extremely fundamentalist state. So that's an incredible weakness which cannot be overcome with money, because, you know, when you tell him, you know, this guy believes that Jesus and the devil are brothers or something, or the same, or whatever the story is, that's going to scare people.
Regardless.
So, I mean, it is money, but it has to be spent in an effective PR campaign, right? And so if you're sort of an average, political figure and you spend money and you don't have any major sort of flaws like that, you can make it, you know.
I think it's important to clarify too is that, it isn't just money. Because, and it's something I've been trying to find this interview by John Lennon. This was done years and years ago, obviously, but he kind of talks about this. And that's because we have this idea that it's just money alone kind of gives you power. And what John learned, obviously he wasn't like a, you know, Mike Bloomberg type wealth, but he had a lot of money. And he realized, even though you've got lots of money, and, you know, and he got radical and he wanted to help these causes, he realized you're still really limited, because the access, whether it is you want to put something out on the TV or the radio or whatever, it's not just about money. And those corporations will turn down things. You know, that goes too far out of the spectrum. And so having, like, we can imagine, like, I don't know, you know, Noam Chomsky blessed with, you know, trillions of dollars. I mean, you know, like, money alone wouldn't give anybody who had radical ideas instant access to power.
Let me give you an example.
Because the system, yeah.
Right, let me give you an example. And I guess next week we'll take the caller, Ronnie Ron, because he's waiting. If you want, Dave, stay with me, because that way we can both answer his queries. But I wanted to mention that like, let's say that I wanted to market my documentary Golden Rule, or some other radical filmmaker or artist wanted to market their stuff. Now, let's say they had the money to pay for a full page ad on the New York Times, which I don't know how much it costs. I'm sure, you know, $60,000-$80,000, you know, whatever it is, a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is not only that, is that the capitalists give each other a lot of free advertising. So, for example, if I come up with a movie that is is sort of has a point of view that is beneficial to the system, not only will I get advertising I get from paying for an ad, but local news stations will make stories about the film. Hey, look, there's a new film out there. It talks about how great the electoral campaign was and all these things. If you are critical about the system, they will not give you those free stories, that free space. So that's a very important element.
Right.
So ideologically, yeah. is that's very important. So anyway, let's see what this caller Ronnie Ron wants. Hello,
mm-hmm.
Are you there? Is this Ronnie Ron?
Ron? Yeah, can
you hear me?
Yeah. Hi. How you doing? Welcome.
I'm good.
Yeah. Maybe you should get a little closer to the microphone. Can you get a little closer? Because you sound a little bit far away.
Yeah, can you hear?
Just raise your voice because you sound pretty low.
I'm sorry. I'm on this like really crappy headset.
I can hear you.
You can hear me?
Hello? Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Do you know what I think? Excuse me. I think that you're probably not connecting the headset to the actual soundboard. So maybe because you sound like you need, if you get closer to the computer, maybe the microphone that is actually connected to the soundboard is the computer. So get closer to the computer. You may get the better audio that way.
Okay, you hear me now?
Yeah. See, that's better. You see?
Okay. After the quote unquote election yesterday, I was thinking about the fascism issue in this country and what you guys thought of that, because it seems like this country is really being, I don't know how to put it, but like ripened up or kind of buttered up fascism. Because, I mean, I think we all know how Sarah Palin and the right wing talk shows, and we all know about
the
left paradigm was kind of false, right, and how we need to be beyond it. The way people are thinking about things now, even though liberals are like the best hope we have right now to get some reforms pushed through, it's ignorance and this debate lunacy is becoming more and more popular. And it seems like because it doesn't look like healthcare is going to get passed, it doesn't look like the condo is going to get passed, people are going to be so frustrated with the economy, they're going to turn to people like Sarah Palin and Rush Limbaugh to answer their questions and to be the leaders in this country. And it really frightens me. And I'm wondering, like, what can we do? I mean, because it seems like Obama, the ship is sinking. If you care about Obama, or if you think he's going to help us, I mean, it's not going to happen. But the left, even though it's really fucked up in this country, it's still the best we have. But right now, like, the ship is sinking. Like, and I just wonder what you guys think about this. And I'll hang up and take my call.
All right. Thanks, Ron.
Yeah, I think we're all a little frightened by the rising tide of fascism, and I think we see it in these Tea Party protests. Of course, the likes of Rush Limbaugh and Mike Savage and the others, and it's frightening. And yet, also those Tea Party protests and people who maybe self-identify as right-wing or conservative, we see angry people, you know, who are angry and frustrated and scared of a system that they don't quite understand. And as Chomsky has pointed out, Noam Chomsky has pointed out numerous times, the real power in this country is often hidden, right? So the only thing left standing, usually holding the bag, is the government. You know, so, you know, when you get angry and frightened at a system you don't quite understand, the only thing there to blame is the government. You know, and so you get and it's very scary. And I think what has been brought up, I think, numerous times, at least in anarchist circles that I run around in, is that for too long we've been ignoring that angry, you know, lower class white person, you know. You know, it's like, yeah, go ahead.
I was thinking, you know, when you said that thing about getting angry at the government, if you compare just in regular conversations when people complain about politics, how many times they mention the word government, yet very few times do we even mention the word capitalist or capitalism. It's sort of a taboo word, like, because if you say the word capitalism immediately, that arises suspicion. It's like, oh, well, what are you, a commie? Or, you know, it's sort of like,
well,
it's,
it's
hard to use that word.
And you have to, I mean, I think as activists and radicals, you have to be aware of that, because, you know, certain words are going to turn people off immediately. You know, when you start, you know, in certain circles bringing up capitalism, but it's tough, because you know what people think of. I think what this is my just what I see, at least, is that very often the normal people that I interact with, they see capitalism as that almost like that lottery ticket, you know, that possibility that they might be able to become the next Bill Gates. You know, and to criticize that is like criticize that hope, that possibility that might get out from under that wage slave job and, you know, the mortgage and all that, you know, the insecurity of having a job and everything that goes along with capitalism. But capitalism also has that, you know, it's the stick and it's the carrot, you know, and that carrot is that dream that we all might become the next billionaire. And it's very hard to criticize that, because it's almost like criticizing going to heaven, because, you know, in a way, you know, saying like, oh, heaven sucks. And you're like, what?
I think when people identify freedom with getting rich or with social mobility, I mean, there's a kernel of truth, because in our society, wealth means that you have a lot of freedom. You have freedom to buy. You have freedom to not have to work. So you have a lot of freedom. But at the same time,
M&M's with peanuts or without peanuts.
Right. If you have money, you can buy a home. You don't need. So I mean, it has advantages. But if people, that's why we are out here trying to present a different notion of freedom, which is freedom as directing your own destinies, as being with people who are not being oppressed and whose whose potential is being realized. Because the problem is that we're not as rich as we could be. We're not as happy as we could be when everyone around us is not contributing in as much solidarity or as much of their own personality and of their own potential as they could, which is what hierarchical systems do, and particularly the sort of exploitative system in which we're in, which does not allow that, which is a very important factor of happiness. And so when you equate happiness and freedom with social mobility, you know, I always sort of give the example of, you know, slaves in colonial Brazil, which could buy their own freedom and then become a business owner, self-employed, or even slave owners themselves. But that somehow didn't mean that the society was free.
Right. And, I mean, just to further address Ron's question, I think we're really, as the left, I think we're really at a crossroads here where, you know, we can't, I think for too long we demonize people on the right who self-identify as conservatives. Many of them are here on Blog Talk Radio. They're on YouTube. They're out. They work with us, you know. And I see these people. They're good people. They're frustrated. They're angry. And I think it's really up to us not to demonize and, like, dehumanize them as people. You know, and we too often, you know, we see these Tea Party protests and we laugh and we characterize and we call them fascists. And it's all fun and games. Those are some really angry and upset people, and I think it's really up to us to reach out to those people, not in a condescending way, not like, oh, hey, you know, you're stupid, you don't really understand the system, let me explain it to you, but by validating, one, their concerns and their frustration, you know, because, you know, a lot of, you know, people don't have jobs, there's no work, and you come to where I think what we have to really understand on the left, as anarchists, as radicals, however you identify, is that we have to come to where people are, you know, not in a condescending way, but it's like, you have to, I mean, it means making a human connection with somebody and saying, wow, you know, you're really upset. You know, yeah, maybe you think it's all because Obama and because Obama's black and whatever fucked up ideas you have. If I want to have an impact, I've got to come to where you are, because somewhere in all that messiness that we kind of tend to like back away from, like, oh, that's some fascist, racist nonsense, there's usually a kernel of real, true frustration.
That's right.
We've got to, you know, and when you find that, you know, all in that muckiness of anger and
90 seconds,
you know, stereotypes and bigotry, you find that little kernel of truth, you know, and you can usually find, you know, make some really strong common ground with people. Like, very often what I do is, I mean, very easily, whatever person's political spectrum, people tend to like the idea of democracy. Especially when you talk about, wouldn't you like to have a say in this? They go,
right.
yeah, you know? And it's like, fuck yeah, that's democracy. You know,
all right,
whatever
folks.
Else, you know, you think I'm an anarchist, whatever.
60 seconds.
You know, let's believe in democracy, you know?
That's we what we're here time, for, so. Folks. Try to push these democratic ideals. So thanks, everyone, for being here. And we'll see you tomorrow. And thanks, Buddha Jam, David, for calling in. And it's always a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks a lot, John.
All right. We're going to play Muse. Nice to see you.